painting to photography, from beadwork to woodworking. KQAL-FM on the campus of Winona State University presents Artbeat. Artbeat highlights the work and accomplishments of local artists from in and around Winona. Support for Artbeat is made possible by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Now, here's Terry Tenseth with today's Artbeat.
On this episode of Artbeat, we conclude our coverage of Winona Poet Laureate Ken McCullough's collection of recent work entitled Farming the Ridge, Yesterday and Today. The collection of stories you will hear were comprised of interviews conducted by McCullough with farmers and their families who live and work on Garvin Heights Ridge in Winona, Minnesota. Today we will hear some of the pieces set with musical accompaniment by violinist Betsy Neal and pianist Mark McGuire. I'm Terry Tenseth, inviting you to enjoy Farming on the Ridge on this episode of Artbeat.
Mike's World. Mike Peeler. I left home when I was 12, pretty much. I worked at Pickert's, out at the end of Buffalo Ridge Road. Paid room and board, and had all I could eat. Grace was a great cook. I was still in high school. I went home every other weekend, but sometimes stayed up there to help. Rather be out on the farm than at home with seven brothers and sisters. Now, I called Ralph to ask him for a job for my older brother. My brother worked there for 6 months. I worked there for 6.5 years. Ralph didn't think I'd be able to lift a bale or do much else. I was a little skinny kid, maybe 130 pounds. It was good eating. Before Ralph farmed, he was a court reporter. In them days I worked for Ralph, whenever there was spare time, we went fishing or we went hunting. One time I had an accident, broke my leg. He borrowed a 410 so I could go squirrel hunting. I can't imagine a kid on crutches with a 410 chasing squirrels through the wood. I did good, got my limit every day. Bring them back, clean them, and Grace would make the best squirrel pot pie that ever was. And we can't match it to this day. When I was on crutches, Grace sent me out to trim the 5 apple trees. Up on the stepladder with my crutches. When I was done, she said, "Where do you think you're going? You're not finished until you can throw a cat through each tree." Together, we would hunt, fish, trap. Even after I got married, Ralph and I were still going out trapping muskrats. And he would trap one side of the farm for fox and coon, and I would trap the other side. All I ever caught was skunk. Ralph had a son, but he treated me like a son too. All through high school, I was teased because I worked on the farm. Two teachers actually stood up for me. One guy teasing me had stovepipe blue jeans, and I had bell-bottom blue jeans. The teacher said, "Which one of the two looks more like a farmer? You do, you city slicker." The other one who stuck up for me was Sister Oliver, our history teacher. She would catch me nodding off and say, "Take a nap, Mike. I know you work on a farm." Bonnie's dad, Bill Lafke, sold this farm 6 months before he passed away. There was no way I could afford to buy it. Now it's 100 acres tillable. When her dad farmed it, it was only 75 acres, not enough to make a living on. So in the past 10 years, when I wasn't making a living with a dozer, I was pushing back the woods where it had grown over. George always thought I made so much land out there. That made me chuckle. I basically put it back to what it was originally. Pushed back the box elder, which had creeped way over the fields. Clear it out. Leave the better stuff. It makes the land more breathable. We don't have anything here now except this house and the lot it sits on. But we have our kids and our grandkids and what I see when I step outside. The Sobeck Report, Gary Sobeck. From here, you can see Peter Sobeck's farm, my great-grandfather. A half mile to the west was Constance Sobeck's farm, my grandpa. And then the farm we're on was Gene Sobeck's, my dad, and it's my farm now. And my son Christopher works with us now, too. My daughter Jenna just got a job in Winona, so she's back helping. My brother Jim has the farm just down the road. We farm together. We've always had dairy cattle, Holsteins. My dad had them, my granddad and great-grandpa had them, too. We have 240 cows. My mother come from over Fremont, a dairy farm too. My brother and I bought that, so we have cattle over there as well. Our barn was built in 1908, and we're still milking in it. You see how good they built the barns back then? It says July 4th, 1908 on the cornerstone. But we never modernized it. We thought someday we'd have a milking parlor, then 10 years ago, they were starting to do robots. And that's what we'll be doing here in the fall now, with Christopher farming and Jenna probably too. The way it's set up is that there's a stall that the cow walks into on its own, and they get milked kind of when they want to. They get lured in with a treat, and the stall closes. The cow has its treat, then machine puts itself on and milks, and shuts itself off when it's done. Every cow's got a collar, so the machine knows what cow it is and what amount to feed. And if that cow comes in too many times, it'll kick the cow out and won't give it no feed. It's all computerized, but Christopher and Jenna are both good with computers. They just type it in, and off she goes. Christopher is 29. Growing up, he had hay fever, was allergic to cows. He went to college at St. John's and worked in the cities for a year or two. One day he called and said he wanted to try farming. He never really had much interest in it before. So he came back and did some putzing around, then he came back again and he did more. So we put him on full time. Now, that's what he wants to do. We have a daughter who was into 4-H and showing cattle and horses. She went to River Falls and got an ag degree. She'd come home for a weekend and go out and chisel plow. Another weekend, she'd come home and milk cows. At one time, it looked like she was the one that would be doing the farming. Just this last week, she transferred down here in the fertilizer division of Cenex Harvest States. She's living with us right now. She's really interested that we're going to start a milking parlor. Our family went on a cruise to Alaska, and Christopher took a shine to a young woman from New York City. I didn't know how this would possibly work out, but she came to visit, and he visited her, and back and forth, and she came to Winona to live, and they got married last year. She just loves it here. Her family was just here last week, and they love the area too. Now he's gung-ho to be a farmer. Like I said, the barn was built in 1908. We put on some additions in 59, but we haven't hardly done anything on it since Dad had it. We took over in 1980, and we're still using what he put together over his lifetime. That was great in 1980, but now it's 34 years later. We weren't going to invest a huge amount of money into the dairy business if we didn't know somebody was going to stay here. My brother Jim has a daughter who's really into farming too, so it looks like the next generation is coming back here. You ask me if I'll retire? No, a farmer never retires.
From Contour Acres to Sahapton Farm and beyond, Lynn Nankaville. In 1970, my husband Jack and I purchased a farm on the ridge from Irv Michael. We had already lived on the ridge since 1962 when we moved to the new Windcrest addition. In spite of all the terrible things we were supposed to find up there, rattlesnakes, terrible winds, dangerous road, we loved living on the ridge from the moment we moved in. At that time, there were only four or five houses occupied, and we were surrounded by farm fields. I had ridden horses as a kid, and now living in the country with three little girls made it almost inevitable that a horse was in our future. One afternoon, we stopped by Roger and Ann Ayler's place, Garvin Heights Ranch, and our fate was sealed. The girls spent every spare moment riding with all the kids that boarded their horses at Garvin Heights. I think Jack was having as good a time with the horses as the girls, and one day he came home with an idea that it would be great fun to have a place of our own. We could probably buy one or two mares and sell the foals. This would likely be a very profitable investment. I neglected to note that I may have married the most optimistic person on earth. One summer in 1970, we drove up the long gravel driveway to speak with Irv Michael about the possible sale of his farm. The farm, Contour Acres, was a dairy farm in its heyday. I still have the names and production records of the 40 brown Swiss cows that the Michael family kept, along with magazine articles about their modern dairy barn that was built from timber harvested on the farm in the late 1930s. Their state-of-the-art dairy barn was designed by the University of Minnesota and was featured in Successful Farming magazine in 1946. A condition of the sale was that Irv could keep Life Estate in the farmhouse where both he and his mother had grown up. He was a wonderful presence on the farm until his passing in 1982. Jerry Stasko became our farm manager, and he and our family worked together to transform the barn into one suitable for horses. The next year saw us traveling with Jerry to horse shows all over the country. I'll never forget how the horses, quiet for the long journeys, would nicker and whinny when the turn was made up that long driveway on our return home. A major change at our farm came when it was announced that Triple Crown winner Secretariat would be retired from racing and bred to an Appaloosa test mare by the name of Leola to see if the famous horse would be a successful sire. The story of how the Nankaville family at a small horse farm in Winona, Minnesota, managed to buy Leola is too long to tell in this account. But by the late summer of 1974, Leola, the little Cinderella mare, was safely in foal to the great racehorse and was now living in one of the newly built stalls in Irv's old dairy barn. In November, she gave birth to a big, leggy, red chestnut colt with Secretariat's same markings and a nice, lacy Appaloosa blanket on his rear. We named him First Secretary, and his birth was covered by television and newspapers around the world. When First Secretary reached breeding age, it was necessary to build a new barn to house all the mares that were booked to our young stallion. Well, all good things must come to an end, and so did the heyday of the horse business. The 1980s were tough times economically. Horse racing was in a decline from which it never really recovered. The farm was doing all right, but we knew it was time for a change. We sold First Secretary to a horse breeder in Maryland, where he stood at stud until he died at the age of 19. My husband Jack fell ill and died a year earlier at the young age of 54 in 1992. My daughter Amy and I ran the horse boarding business for several years until a terrible fire destroyed both barns while they were being remodeled as a veterinary clinic in 2001. The sight of the burning barn and the loss of all the clinic's horses was one I'll never forget. It's the thing every farm owner dreads. Happiness and sadness are contained in any story that involves animals and the land. Anyone on the ridge can tell you that. If you have driven past our farm in the last few years, you have no doubt seen row upon row of grapevines covering the hillside. Rebirth is always possible when the land has been cared for. I do miss the mares and foals cavorting in the pastures, but those hardy grapes that each year defy the Minnesota winter tell a good story too.
For this piece, Terry will read the voice of Amy Nankaville. The title is Compliments. That's compliment with an E. Amy Nankaville and Peter Shortridge.
When I was a kid, it was not only a horse farm with 3 breeding stallions and 70 brood mares coming for breeding, but we were raising our own feed. We had our tractors and our equipment. I knew how to windrow the hay. We were actually cropping the farm. In the early 80s, we put the land into CRP. We liked the idea that the pheasant population was coming back. We had fewer horses then. But when you're not cropping, noxious species start to take over. Buckthorn, locust, crown vetch. We had to do some reclaiming of the land.
If we look around, we can see some of what we've reclaimed, some of the erosion we've repaired. Now you can see some of those contours they put in with the teams of horses in the 40s, these beautiful undulations along the bluff side. Some were quite deep in the woods, and it's kind of neat that some of them are still down there disguised. This year, we have sandhill cranes for the first time, and we have all the species of bumblebees, and the monarchs are in resurgence.
I love to look out our bedroom window facing east and see our mowing patterns flowing, following the contours as they go along the lip of the catch pond. Last year, we saw a fox in our yard. Some people see these things all the time. Riding out on the trail, we used to see skunks. I haven't seen skunks in years and years, but now there are skunks up here. You can find ginseng and ginger in the woods, and the morels, of course, have always been here. On a day like this on a farm, you must be outside. Farms are very much about seasons. We're just visitors here. All this work we've done, who knows if in a generation or two that this will be maintained. I don't like change very much. On the other hand, this farm is growing and evolving. First contour anchors, where Irv raised brown Swiss cows, then it was our Appaloosas. Now the biggest organic vineyard in Minnesota. What's the next step?
To be quite honest, we don't make our living on this farm. So our decisions about land stewardship can be idealistic. You would think that those for whom this is their livelihood would have more reason to make good stewardship decisions, but it's not always the case. Sometimes there are trade-offs. Chemicals that make things easier or less labor-intensive. Practices that increase yield short-term because of commodity prices. Now, do we hope that the orchard and vineyard will someday be a sustainable business? Yes, we do. And after 7 years of doing this vineyard business, we are just learning it. It's not just about how many pounds of corn and soybeans or even grapes or apples. It's about how people can use the land.
Any of these farmers up and down the ridge, none of them would have done it if they didn't like what they were doing, if they didn't like the lifestyle. But children have left because they see how hard the life is. When my family moved up here, we didn't know much. So our neighbors helped us, became our teachers. If we could make a living, our living, working on this farm, from dawn to midnight every day, I'd do it in a second.
The Hmong gardeners, Yi Vang and Lu Zhong. Peter plows up the ground for us, and sometimes we plant in rows like you do, short ones, but usually in patches like at home. We never use tractors there, that's why. We use simple tools like we did at home. We grew mostly rice, but never sold it. It was subsistence farming. We'd work about an acre of land. We moved a lot. That was our tradition. We hunted small game and gathered wild plants in the woods. Not so much here. But farming is much easier here. People have told us that we should sell our produce at the farmer's market, but we just grow it for the family. 9 kids, 27 down to 7. They all do well in school. Lou and I come from different villages in District 9, Laos, a 3-hour walk from the Mekong. When I stand here and look across the hills, I see fields that look a lot like ours at home. We had two seasons, and we didn't have clocks or calendars. When a certain bird appeared, you knew it was time to plant corn. Our trees are bigger, and you don't have bamboo. Our cucumbers are huge compared to yours, and their pulp isn't watery and tastes like pudding. I've heard about organic farming. Our garden is always organic. No chemicals, not even fertilizer.
We met in Ban Vinay, Thailand, where we both spent almost 7 years in UN refugee camps, very hard. But we made some friends. At home, we practice shamanism, but now we are Christian, though we still honor our ancestors. We came here in 1988. Yes, I miss home, but Ye doesn't like to travel. I do. I'd like to return for a visit, but there's no money. Instead, I talk on the phone with my relatives. My kids would like to see their homeland. If we didn't have a big garden like this, both of us would feel only half alive. Down in the valley, Dolores Rackstead. I remember when the soil conservation program was just getting started around here. Dad was all for it. He'd go around with the government men in the evenings to all the little country schools because some farmers wanted to hear about the program. They'd show slides and talk. They brought Dad along because he was not an outsider and he could speak about the program firsthand. Farmers were hard to convince. They weren't too sure about the idea of strips and zigzagging around. They didn't see the need for it. It was the late 30s, early 40s. I was in grade school. I remember when they put in the terraces down here at my uncle's place. People came from all over to see it. I had to talk on the radio one time. I think I was 6 or 7. I had a little speech they'd printed out for me, telling how my dad used to farm, but now he's doing it in a more efficient way. My husband continued those practices, but these days they don't grow much hay anymore and there's no cattle, so it's all cropped mostly. It bothers me. I guess with prices being what they are, they do what they have to do. Our one-room school, number 111, was very small. 13 students was the most at any one time for 8 grades. I loved my little country school. We didn't have any playground equipment at our school until a day in November 1940. My dad and Arnold Hobby, who was a local plumber, arrived and began putting up pipes and hanging swings, and they also made a teeter-totter. They cemented in everything. That morning was so nice. We were watching out the windows, so excited that we were going to have playground equipment. We'd never had any before. At best, we'd just bat a ball around. But by 11 o'clock, it had grown real stormy. It's lucky they started that morning because the cement hardened before it got cold. By the end of the day, 27 inches of snow had fallen, and there were 12-foot drifts in places. The winds, they say, got up to 80 miles an hour, and the temperature dropped 50 degrees. 49 people died in Minnesota alone. A number of duck hunters were trapped on the river, but a local flyer named Max Conrad braved the blizzard and flew up and down the river, locating the hunters, and he dropped them supplies. It was a terrible tragedy. We didn't know anyone trapped in the storm. I don't miss the hard rain and wind up there on the ridge, but down here in the valley, I can't see the beautiful sunsets and the double rainbows. My husband farmed up there, and when he retired, he kept on farming up there. Farmers seem to do that.
A man's best friend, Nick Reddick. We used to have a printing business with my in-laws in La Crosse, and we'd get done with the farm work during the day, and sometimes it wouldn't be until 6 o'clock before we'd leave for La Crosse. The kids would always ride along with us, and my wife Lynn would always have books on tape for the kids to listen to, like Cinderella or the Jungle Books, Sometimes those stories are kind of monotonous, and I would get sleepy while I was driving. One evening, when we were on our way to La Crosse, Lynn said, "I think you're going to like this one. It's a series done by a rancher in Texas. It's called Hank the Cow Dog. And Hank is a kind of mangy old mutt that's head of ranch security. And the rancher does all of the voices in the story. He's got a real talent for reading and keeps it interesting." So we listened to the tapes, and all of us were really drawn into the story. Right around then, we needed a farm dog. So we got a big fella, and the kids, of course, named him Hank. Also in the story, the sidekick of Hank the cow dog is Drover, the runt with the sawed-off tail. Even though Hank is the head of security, it's Drover who is the brains of the outfit. So the next dog we got was Small. He's a Jack Russell Terrier. And when the kids picked him out, they right away named him Drover, after the little runt with the sawed-off tail. So we had our own personal version of Hank the cow dog. That was 11 years ago. Drover is my sidekick. Where I go, he goes. He helps me drive the pickup. He helps me steer the combine while keeping a vigilant eye out for mice and other rodents. He can't see as well as he used to. Cataracts are starting to cloud his eyes. And he isn't as fast when he spots a rabbit and I let him out to chase it down. But he is my constant companion, my best friend. So this last piece is titled Triggers by Bob Reddig. There were lots of wild plums in the fence rows, and when they bloomed, they put out a sweet smell. And there were lilacs on almost every farm. In fact, that big hedgerow over by you has been there forever. And in the springtime, the aroma of the apple trees. When the white blossoms of the honey locusts come in, they are pretty to look at, and fragrant too, but people think of them as nothing more than weeds. And this time of year, everybody is spreading manure, and now it's maybe emptying the pit. It smells like liquid gold, because commercial fertilizer costs so much. The rain itself has a really great smell that I'm sure is different in different places. But one of the nicest smells, of course, is hay that's new cut, alfalfa. And then if it's conditioned, crinkled a bit, the smell of hay when it's dry and ready to bale, or a load of hay in the barn if it isn't heating, a load that's dried and stored. With good silage, I have to pick it up and smell it because it's so good. If you are filling silo, a lot of the silage spills out the side, and if you don't clean it up and it rains overnight and then it gets hot and muggy and starts molding, that's a whole nother smell, a bad one, like rancid butter. Rancid butter, but one you'd recognize right away. When you get it on your clothes, it won't come off. But both our families were German. We made silage the same way we made sauerkraut. Dairy farmers back east made it from green corn fodder, and it caught on out here. There's the smell of the dairy barn, summer or winter. We used to milk by hand, so you smelled the milk in the pail, and that had a very nice vapor to it. Even the cows. Their breaths can be bad, or it can be pretty good if they are happy. So, a contented barn has its own certain smell, too. After the cows go out in the pasture, the manure is loose. It's very fresh, distinctive, mixed with the grass, and they're crushing the grass and lying on it. So when the cows are pasturing, there's a tremendous number of smells that would trigger your memories of this place. We used to have hives up here, and when it was hot, the bees would be fanning. I'd move in close, and the action of their wings would waft the smell of honey from the boxes. There's still some wild plums down in the woods, but very few. They used to be kind of thick in the fence rows. Our neighbor George, instead of cleaning out the fence row, he just moved the fence in a little more, so it came to be about 16 feet wide. So we had to cut that back. We must have grubbed out all the plums when I was in high school, which was bad for the birds, but simplified things. That's where all the plums were. We did save a few, transplanted here in the yard, so I can still breathe in their scent, taste that tart jam.
Thank you to Ken McCullough, Lynn Nankville, Betsy Neal, and Mark McGuire. More information on today's presentation, Farming on the Ridge, Yesterday and Today, and more information on Ken McCullough, Winona's Poet Laureate, can be found at www.kenmccullough.com. Another thank you also goes out to the Winona County Historical Society. More information on the Society can be found at www.winonahistory.org. I'm Terry Tenseth, and you've been listening to Art Beat.
Art Beat is written and produced by KQAL-FM on the campus of Winona State University. Visit us on the web at kqal.org.